because we're burning daylight. Let's pray. Lord, I ask that you speak to all of us concerning our lives, especially through the lives of David and all the back and forth in terms of the things that were happening around him. And I ask that you bless it with focus tonight in Jesus' name. Amen. I've got up here that we're going to look at 2 Samuel chapter 3, verses 1 to 5 and 6 to 11. And we actually looked at those last week, so I'm going to quickly read them and comment on them, and we're going to move on. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And that was that gives you a commentary on what was going on after the death of Saul. And it lets you know that David's kingship was growing, basically. And sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn went to Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel. His second, Chileab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And the third, Absalom, the son of Maachah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. And the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. And the fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithraim of Eglah, David's wife. They were born to David in Hebron. Now, he was in Hebron for 7.5 years. And we talked about this in terms of how problems begin here, as you have six wives with six sons and all that goes with that. And every mother that I know of is for her kid. So you have the beginning of issues. That all make sense? And I talked a little bit more about that last time, but we won't go into it. Go out there and get the CD. While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, this is verses 6 through 11, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. He was growing in strength. If these were companies instead of kingdoms, it would be like Abner was trying to take over the company that he was involved in. It would be like Microsoft and Apple or something like that. But that's what's going on, and Abner is trying to take over and get as much of a glory as he can. Now, Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, who the temple was named after. I'm sorry, I can only do it straight so long, and I just started. The daughter of Aiah and Ishbosheth said to Abner, now Ishbosheth is Saul's son who is being acting as king of Israel. That's the tribe of Benjamin and the other tribes. And Abner is his right-hand man, you might say, in charge of all the armies. Ishbosheth said to Abner, why have you gone into my father's concubine? Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, am I a dog's head of Judah? Now, Judah is where David's from. That's the tribe of Judah. This day I keep showing loyalty to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David, and yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. Basically, he said, who are you talking to? Are you kidding me? I've been taking care of business around here, and you too, and not turned you over to David. What are you doing? I'll do what I want to do with whatever women I want to. Basically is what he says. God do so to Abner and more also if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. And well, he should, because Abner has taken over running the country, even though Ishbosheth is supposedly the king of Israel. That's where we left off last time in terms of this. And basically, Abner's the real power in Israel. And David's guy is named Joab. And he's the head of the armies of Judah, you might say. And so just keep that in mind, because sometimes you got to learn who the players are. I watch things like Game of Thrones, and it's just hard to keep track of everybody that's in there. But anyway, Abner, it was the right-hand man of Saul, and Ish-bosheth is Saul's son. Abner became the head of the armies and kept that. On David's side, Joab is the head of the armies that David has. There's a little bit difference in terms of Joab's power, though. Okay, we're going to pick up here at verses 12 to 16, because this is an interesting little piece here. And Abner sent messengers to David at Hebron, saying, "To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you." In other words, Abner is doing exactly what he said that he was going to do to Ish-bosheth, which is, he says, "I'm going to bring this together," and he's trying to work his own kind of deal here with David. And he's going to, so he can become powerful, because he can see the handwriting on the wall that David is slowly taking over and growing stronger and stronger. And you can read it in verse 1 where it says there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And so Abner's just taking care of business in terms of himself. And that's what he's saying here. He says, and he said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." Now, those of you who were in the study last spring, when David was running for 12 years, after he killed Goliath and he was doing all I think I even wrote it down here. Let me see if I did. Oh, where is it? Oh, yeah, 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 25. And I want to read it to you. This has to do with Michal. Michal is the daughter of Saul. Now, everything's changed, but nothing's different. Everything's different, but nothing's changed. This kind of stuff goes on today in terms of how people deal with things and say. 1 Samuel 18:25. "Then Saul said, 'Thus shall you say to David, the king desires no marriage present except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemy.' Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines." Saul was already talking against David, but what he's saying here is, "You can have Michael's hand in marriage if you bring me 100 foreskins of the Philistines." Now, that's kind of like taking scalps, but not quite. Just saying. Anyway, Saul gives Michal to David. Then, but he's already got it in his heart to go after David. So when Michal gets stripped from David too, and he gets run out of town, and he loses Michal. So what is going on here is that, okay, he's coming to power now, and more power. David has more and more power, and he says, I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you, Abner, if you bring me Saul's daughter, Michal." Okay? That's what's going on here. Then David sent message to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife, Michal, whom I betrothed at the price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines." That's where what I just read back in 1 Samuel 18:25. "And Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband, Paltiel, the son of Laish, but her husband went with her, weeping after her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, 'Go, return,' and he returned." Now, I want to say something here. This is one of these things that there are all kinds of eddies and currents and webs of intrigue and winds that blow through families and things like that, and we have them in our lives. And in this particular case, my question was, well, who's the bad guy here? You know, David, who is now the power in Israel, he wants his wife back that was taken from him when he was chased out of Saul's house. But now he's the head of the government, you might say, and he says, "I want my wife back." This is government intervention here. It really is. I mean, basically, he says, I want her back. And she's married to this other guy by the name of Paltiel at this point in time. And what's he going to do? He must be in love with Michael. Because they come in and says, hey, she's coming with us. And he just strips this guy of his wife. The government does this. Got it? The government. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you. Okay. Don't think this stuff doesn't happen these days either. It does. You know, there's all kinds of government intervention in people's lives, and this is a very, very interesting one in which David wants his ex-wife back. Actually, it's not his ex-wife. It's his wife. And she was taken from him because he would run out of town. And he wants his wife back. Well, Paltiel, he's been married to her now for a few years. And suddenly he's going to get stripped of his wife because it's a government intervention. I think it's really interesting. And who's the bad guy? Is David the bad guy? You know, is he or not? I mean, this is one of those places where you got a lot of gray area here because of what happened years before when Saul ran David out of town and he lost his relationship with Michael. And I got to thinking about this. I said, this is very, very close to real life. Sometimes you can't tell who's the bad guy in some of our situations and circumstances in this life. It may be that it's just life. You know? And I look at this particular thing, and poor Paltiel, I mean, you know, he's got his wife, and suddenly the government comes in and just strips him. Don't think the government can't do that. You know? If you want to talk about kingdoms and kingdoms inside. Did you see on the suddenly the EU wants to take $12 billion from Apple? That's one kingdom attacking another kingdom in this world right now. They just don't wear knight's garb and stuff like that. But that's exactly what's going on, is Apple is being attacked by the European Union. Because they have a favorable tax system in Ireland where they are. Don't tell me a government intervention isn't around here and things don't happen. Because that's one of the things is, if there's anything bad here, it's the government intervention in people's lives. But I wouldn't call David the bad guy in this. He's just wanting his wife back. That was taken from him, and he's finally in a position where he can actually go get her. Now, I'm not sure about his choice of women, because she's not particularly good for him, but, you know, it's just going on there. So anyway, I look at this stuff and says, this is all taking place, by the way, in a 2-year period with Ishbosheth, because that's the only time that he was a king. Okay, verses 17 and 19. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, for some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. And he's going back and he's talking to all the people of Israel that Saul's kingship was over. And he says, hey, you've been seeing what's been going on with David for quite some time here. You see that this guy is pretty good at what he's doing in terms of his kingship and taking care of business around here and taking care of our enemies. And that's what Abner's doing right here. He says, for some time past, you've been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about. For the Lord has promised David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. In other words, he's talking to these tribes. There's 10 tribes out there besides Benjamin, which was Saul's tribe, and Judah, which was David's tribe. And he says, listen, We know the prophecies. We know that Samuel anointed him because it had to become common knowledge. You've seen what he's done. We need to get behind this guy and elect him king, basically. Now, we know this. I know this. Just from reading this, Abner is feathering his own nest, don't you think? That's what he's doing. Hey, you know, he's doing that. And I want you to remember one thing about David. David is a man after God's own heart, but not the rest of them. Not the rest of them. So keep it in mind. But God is with David. That's why he has success. Everything he does is because God is with him, because he chose him. So anyway, Abner's going on here about this and saying, hey, Abner also spoke to Benjamin. Now, when he says Benjamin, that's the tribe of Benjamin. And then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. So he goes, and he goes to see David and says, they want to join with you. They want you as king over them too. Got it? And that's what's going on. And this is an alliance of power. Abner's feathering his own nest at the same time. You know, humanity is working here. The government is being consolidated. And Abner's working a deal, and he's taking care of himself. That's what's going on. Hey, we got all these politics going on now and everything. Do not think that there aren't things going on behind the scenes on both sides of this stuff, and this is real humanity, and I am not hearing any candidate out there talking about God at all. Are you? Keep it in mind. Everything's different, but nothing's changed. And keep it in mind. Verses 20 to 25. Now remember, Abner was the one, he was with Saul. But you remember last week we talked about a battle between Abner and Joab and that bunch. And they came together. Do you remember that? And Abner killed Joab's brother. And there's bad blood between the commander of David's armies and the commander of Saul's armies. Bad blood, folks, bad blood. Okay? Verses 20. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will rise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away and he went in peace. And so what they're doing is they are solidifying this action in terms of government, alliance of power. Abner's in there. Well, where's Joab in all this? Verse 22, just then the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. We don't know who they raided, but probably Philistines. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. In other words, David is dealing with Abner above board and saying, okay, we're going to make an alliance here. We're going to get this thing together, and that's where they are. Now, he knows, I am sure he knows about this thing with Joab and Abner that happened earlier, but he's kind of, I don't know. Sometimes I think David is a little naive. As I read his story, he doesn't seem to have any guile. And because of that, he doesn't see it in other people, I don't think, as much as if he knew what was going on. Because people can be mean and sneaky, but I don't see David being that way until Satan gets a hold of him later on. But he just seems to be an upright kind of guy, and I think that's why he's a man after God's own heart. Even when he had Saul in his hands and he could have killed him twice, he didn't, and when he cut off that robe, it broke his heart because he went against who he was loyal to in terms of his kingship. So I just get this feeling that David is pretty just upright. He says, okay, we make the deal, we make the deal. And so he does that. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away and he'd gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace. Then Joab went to the king and said, what have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he is gone? You know that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you and to know you going, you're going out and you're coming in and to know all that you are doing. In other words, he's saying, listen, you know about Abner. But Joab doesn't say he's out to get Abner. And to tell you the truth, Joab is probably right that Abner's just checking everything out, and he's sneaky as some of these other guys. And so he probably was trying to figure out what David's up to and just kind of get a feel for things and everything like that. And so Joab's probably right. He is being sneaky coming in here. He wants to know what you're doing. But Joab has an axe to grind too, and his axe to grind is the fact that he's got bad blood towards Abner, who killed his brother, and we looked at that last week. So you got to keep this in mind. There's all kinds of things going around David at this point in time, and he's the king. Now, you are a king or a queen too. You have a kingdom. And depending on how big your kingdom is or how spread out it is or how little it is, you got people who have other kingdoms that brush up against yours all the time. I know this. We all have this. Companies come against companies, or they rub up against companies and they make alliances with one another. Families do that. People do that with one another. We become friends with one another. It says, I'm your friend, and so we back somebody up. Or this is all very much like our lives right here. The only difference is that you're looking at a nation doing this, but it's still around one guy by the name of David. He's a king. But you know, Joab's a king in his own right, too. He's got his little part of that kingdom in there. So's Abner. He's got his part of that kingdom. Oh, Paltiel had his own kingdom with Michael, and the government came in, and a kingdom ripped that kingdom apart. Joab, he says, wait a minute. What are you doing letting Abner in here for? And as I said, I think David's a little bit naive. I think he's without guile. You know, he's straight up. And I think that's one of the reasons why people came to him initially anyway when he was on the run. He's straight up. He is loyal to a fault with Saul. And he's a man after God's own heart. So he doesn't deal in that kind of stuff, deception and things like that. Now, he does later. But that's when things go sour on him, inside of him. But at this point in time, I don't see it. Verses 26. When Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah. But David did not know about it. In other words, Joab goes behind his back. He says, I'm going to get that Abner. And so he goes after him. But he doesn't tell David he's going to do this, because David would have said, no, you're not. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he smote him in the belly so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. In other words, as soon as he came back into town, he got him off to the side and just killed him. Didn't ask permission, didn't do anything. He says, I got bad blood with this guy, and I'm going to take him down. And Abner wasn't smart enough to figure that out because he thought he was all right because David said he was all right, and Joab's supposed to be his right-hand man. But Joab, at this point in time, is in rebellion. And he takes him down. Don't tell me this is modern-day stuff. It is. The only difference between this time and our time is our technology. Verse 28, afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house, and may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge or who is leprous or who holds a spindle or who is slain by the sword or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, slew Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel in the battle at Gibeon. Verse 30 is just basically giving you the encapsulated version. This is why it took down. I want you to notice something here. David curses Joab. Now, I want to talk a little bit about blessings and curses. Anybody here ever blessed anybody? Huh? Anybody ever hear curse anybody? By the way, you can't just do it in your mind. You have to say it. But here you have a full-blown curse taking place. And this curse is coming out of the lips of a man who is after God's own heart, who God favors. It's a curse. And it is a righteous curse. Now, the thing about blessing, have you ever blessed it? I mean, like maybe your son or a daughter says, son, you really did a good job at that. That was really good. That's a blessing in its own way. A curse is, you know, I knew you'd never do that right because you're not any good anyway. That's a curse. I've heard parents do that to their children. I've heard parents bless their children. I know this, that I'm in a position of authority and I work with a lot of you people, and every so often I say, you know, that was really good. And when you do that to people, and you should bless people, and you have to do it verbally. You can bless them in your mind, and the Lord blesses them. Did you get that one? No, I didn't either. You know, but you bless people, you know. And I comment on people's in terms of that. I try not to curse them, but, you know, I'm sure I have. You catch me in a bad mood or in a bad day, you know, who knows what I might, what creep out of my mouth, a curse. But here you have, this is a righteous curse here that he's doing here. And he spoke it out. And I want you to hear what he's talking about here when he says this. May it fall upon the head of Joab, upon his father's house. A house never be without one who has a discharge. You remember the woman who had bled for 12 years and that touched the Jesus robe? I think that's what they're talking about here. You have a woman in your household who is sick, and it's female sickness that is taking place here, or who is leprous. Leprosy was big back then, but it could be just a sickness of any kind that is constantly wearing on them. Or who holds a spindle? I think this one is probably about, may you have an old maid in your house. Someone who has never been married, never had children, never been loved. May this come out of your house, Joab. May this happen to you because of what you have done this day. Or who is slain by the sword. That is, part of your family is going to die violently. Or who lacks breath. And some of your household can be poor in terms of this. Now, by the way, if you look at Joab's story, these things begin to happen. So can you curse people? Yes, you can. Can you bless people? Yes, you can. In this particular instance, though, this was a righteous curse. This was intentional in nature. And do you think God listens to that? I guarantee you he does, especially a person like David, because David is the man after God's own heart, and he has dominion. Any father or mother, you have dominion over your children from there all the way up. Actually, I can still bless or curse my kids, even though they're all grown. I can bless or curse people in this congregation or out on the street or anyway. I can do that. And if I'm righteous in nature, if I really, my heart is right, I can throw a good fashioned Old Testament curse on somebody. And let me tell you something. I've done it, and I've seen the result of it. And I'll tell you what, a healthy respect for who you're dealing with is always important. It says the beginning of wisdom, the beginning of knowledge is a fear of the Lord. And it's a healthy respect for who you're dealing with, because God is actually with people and he is for people. And that's why I said, you know, I'm not going to go against people that I can see that are working for God, because if he's for them and I get in their way, don't do it, Lord. Good old-fashioned, this is a good old-fashioned curse in the Old Testament. One thing I learned, Christians, is I know we're supposed to be loving and kind and all those things and things, but you know what? Righteous anger is okay. Do you also know that evil is not okay? And we don't always have to turn the other cheek in order to, because we're protecting somebody else. And sometimes people are evil. And you ought to stand against it. It may have, you know, in terms of turning the other cheek, we are supposed to turn the other cheek for ourselves. That is one thing, you know, I've done that with people who come out against me at times, but there's another thing is, you know, if I see somebody going after somebody else, and I know that they've got evil in their heart, I am going to pray against them. But I also know this, I'm not the judge. All I'm doing is say, Lord, you know their hearts. You know my heart. You know what's going on here. So I ask you to deal with it according to your will. Anyway, David here is in dominion. He is the king. And his number one guy goes out and does this behind his back and goes against David. And David curses him. And let me tell you what, that curse comes down to play in his family later on. Galatians chapter 5, I think it is, 5 and 6. God is not mocked. Whatever you plant comes up. By the way, David, down the road, goes against God and displeases God terribly. And God tells him, he says, you're forgiven, but you are going to suffer these kinds of consequences because of your actions. And we'll look at that a little later on. But one of the things is we're looking at David here, he's a man after God's own heart. And I'm going to tell you once again that what that means is that's loyalty. We call it faithfulness, but he is loyal to God. He is loyal to a fault with his life because he was loyal to Saul because Saul was the king. And he says, I will not act against my own king. And he was loyal. And we walked through his life, and there were two or three times when he was grieved in his own heart because he went against Saul. And when he found out that other people went against Saul, he had them killed. Loyalty. That is God's issue. Whether or not you are loyal to God, that's the issue. And David is constantly grieved in his life by traitorous actions. He gives honor to people. And his word to Abner was good. But Joab went against that. Now, I'm going to tell you another thing is, and this is the truth. And this is true of all of us. The way you see the world is the way you judge the world around you, and that's how you judge people. But it is not the way the world is. The way you judge is the way you are. And David judges in terms of loyalty. And that's the way he is. As he judges, as he sees the world, so is he. And so are you, and so am I. As I see the world, that's the way I am. It's not the way the world is. It's the way I see the world. It's your viewpoint. It's actually your judgment. That's why it says in the Sermon on the Mount, don't judge. By the way, it's not saying anything about judging people. It's saying don't judge because with the way you judge is the way you're going to get it back. And what that means is that has nothing to do with people. That has to do with how you see the world. The way you judge the world is the way you are, not the way the world is. You know, I am amazed at the difference in viewpoints in politics, because I know this, that the way those that are on the right see the world is not the way the ones on the left see the world. And the truth is, the way the ones on the right see the world is not the way the world is, it's the way they are. And the ones that are on the left, they see the world, it's not the way the world is, it's the way they are. In order to see truly, you've got to let the Bible become your lens. You've got to let God work in you to such a way that your lens become, you never judge. You let the lens judge that you have. Now, that is a lifelong job to try and get yourself out of yourself and let God work through you. Okay, anyway. So, he curses Joab here. Verses 31 to 39. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, rend your clothes and gird on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David followed the bier, and they buried Abner at Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen. In other words, he was judging Joab, and those words speak right there. And David is grieved in his spirit because this took place, this treachery took place under his watch. And he did that in front of all the people. I think this is one of the reasons why David was loved so much, is because you knew he was upright. He's not without sin, but he was upright. He was a man after God's own heart. You could see it in his actions and the way he treated people. All the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day, but David swore, saying, God do so to me and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. In other words, they were watching him. By the way, somebody's always watching you too. But they were watching him. They were watching how, whether or not these were crocodile tears or whether this was real grief. And he was grieved because of the treachery that was involved in the death of Abner. He's not saying anything about the character of Abner at this point in time. He's just talking about the treachery. And it grieved him so bad that he said, I'm not eating today. And this is a day of mourning for this person. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to slay Abner, the son of Ner. I think this stuff gets around to people, you know? And the king said to his servant, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And we know a little bit about Abner. Conniving and everything else. We know that because we've read some of the story of this, but that stuff happens behind the scenes and it doesn't happen out in front of people. And Abner was the warrior general for Saul and fought against the Philistines, the enemies of the country. So a general has fallen in the midst of this. Verse 39, and this day weak, though anointed king, these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too hard for me. The Lord requite the evildoer according to his wickedness. In other words, he's basically saying, I'm disassociating from Joab and his work here. Chapter 4, how am I doing? Okay. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 12, that's the whole chapter. When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. That's all of Saul's kingdom. Because Abner was the covering. He was the guardian of Israel. And Ishbosheth was, he shouldn't have been king. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of one was Baana, and the name of the other Rechab, or Rechab, sons of Rimmon, a man of Benjamin from Beeroth, for Beeroth also is reckoned to Benjamin. That's part of the Benjamin tribe. Beerothites fled to Gittaim and have been sojourners there to this day. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled at his feet. Now, you remember that Jonathan and David were good. They were friends in the greatest sense of that word, friends. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. Now remember this guy. Mephibosheth ends up at the table of David down the road. But because of the politics and the warring between clans and everything else, they grabbed up Jonathan's son and took him, and he was hurt because of an accident when he was carried off and they were running for their lives. So he's a cripple. Now the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab, and Baana set out, and about the heat of the day they came to the house of Ishbosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. And behold, the doorkeeper of the house had been cleaning wheat, but she grew drowsy and slept. So Rechab and Baana, his brother, slipped in. When they came into the house as he lay on his bed in his bedchamber, they smote him and slew him and beheaded him. In other words, what is happening is when Abner went down, the tribes of Israel were going to be joining up with David. And one of the things that always seemed to happen is you destroy the house of your enemy. And what I mean by house is not the building, it's the family. And so they killed him. They took his head and went by the way of the Arabah all night and brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. As they said to the king, "Here's the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life, and the Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day on Saul and all his offspring." But remember about David, his issue is the same as God's. It's loyalty. But David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and slew him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have slain a righteous man in his own house upon his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth?" And David commanded his young men, and they killed them, and cut off their hands and feet, and hanged them beside the pool at Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it at the tomb of Abner at Hebron. Once again, David, his issue is loyalty. You could call it faithfulness if you want to. And he's a man after God's own heart. And if you don't get anything else out of all this story about David, this is why David's house was the house that the Messiah was going to come out of, because he was loyal to God. Now, the principle here is, I don't know about your heart, I know about my heart, but if I'm loyal to God, he's loyal to me. If I'm faithful to God, he will be faithful to me. And if I'm faithful to God, I'm going to be faithful to the people that I am in relationship with, no matter how that relationship works. That's what David was saying. He says, "I was the king's servant because he was king of this world, our nation. And I would not lift my hand against the king. I am loyal." And every time this stuff happens, he takes him to task over it. He says, "You have been disloyal to your king. When you killed Ishbosheth, you went into his house and took him down." David constantly deals with treachery, and he does it with justice and vengeance. It's a principle for living. If I want to be God's man in this world, faithfulness is the issue. Faithful to God. Do not go after other gods. Do not go after, make other things the priorities in your life. Make sure that that relationship with God is the priority in your life. And all the other stuff kind of falls around you in terms of how that works. And that's what we were looking at in terms of David's life. And that is not about church. That is about you and your relationship with God. Period. How is your heart in terms of this kind of stuff? Now, we're going to see David, and he's going to be a sinner of great caliber in terms of his sinning. But in the midst of all that, he is still a man after God's heart. And it is because of that relationship that he does find forgiveness. And he does find that God loves him. Doesn't mean everything goes well for him, but it does mean that God is for him. Okay, chapter 5. Now, we looked at chapter 5, and I'm going to kind of bring this along here. Chapter 5, verses 1 to 5 is kind of what I looked at last week at the beginning. It's the encapsulated version of his life. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you that led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron. And King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And at Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. Now, a couple of things about this, and I'll just restate it. He becomes king at the age of about 38. Okay? If he had 12 years of trouble that he was traveling, we don't know for sure exactly, but he became king at the age of 30. So all the trouble that happened before then, he became king over everything at the age of 30. He was in Hebron for 7.5 years. We heard about the 6 women who had sons, right? So we know that he'd got 6 kids during this 7.5 year period by 6 different women. We know that Ish-bosheth has been killed, and all the tribes of Israel have now come together under David while he is reigning at Hebron. Okay? So at the age of 38, thereabouts, he becomes king over all of Israel. Now, he hasn't got Jerusalem yet, but he becomes king at the age of 38. One of the things that we're looking at, he is in midlife at this point in time, folks. Midlife is a scary place to be between the ages of 35 and 50, and it's going to get him into trouble, and we're going to look at this in terms of this. Verses 6 through 12. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, "You will not come in here, but the blind and the lame will ward you off," thinking, "David cannot come in here." Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And David said on that day, "Whoever would smite the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul. Therefore it is said, 'The blind and the lame shall come into the house.'" And David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built a city round about from the Millo in. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him. This is where he's becoming a great and powerful monarch, basically a king. And what he's been doing over these years is he's been putting together things. He has always been loyal. He's always been faithful. He's been for his people, his men. He's a shepherd of the people of Israel. He takes care of them. And he has been doing this for years and years and years, and he has led them with a steady hand. You need to hear that, because in terms of our lives, this is one of the things that's very important, a steady hand. You are the king or queen of your kingdom. How do you rule in it? You know, and one of the things that you have to, what is my relationship with God? Am I a man or a woman after God's own heart? Am I or not? Am I running what I have, I'm responsible for, with a steady hand? Am I for the kingdom? This is where you're for your spouse, you're for your kids, you're for anybody that works for you, you're anything you're responsible over. You become king over those things. And when you become king, what happens when you become successful? This is important to know, too. David is now living in success. He has defeated the enemies that he's had in terms of his life. He has remained loyal to the king, you might say, and then he has let God work in his life in terms of these things, and now he's got to that place where he's got a lot of clout, you might say. He's a king, a great and powerful king. I know this about David. Without it saying anything of it, he is a man who has a strong spirit. He's a man who has a lot of passion in terms of his life. And now he's become successful. For every person who can handle travesty and suffering and everything else, for every 100 that can handle that stuff, one can handle success. Very few people can be trusted with this kind of power that he has in his hand at this point in time. That old saying, power corrupts, and ultimate power corrupts ultimately. Well, let me tell you something. We have that stuff going on in this country. We have that stuff going on in the world all the time. We also have us to look at. For all of us, we all have kingdoms. You are the star of your life. The rest of it may be bit players in your life, you know, but you're the star of your life, and we all have kingdoms. What happens when you become successful? That is, things go your way. Well, what begins to happen that time is then there become unique forms of temptation that come your way. And we're going to be looking at it because the more successful, the more clout you have, the more of all everything that you have in terms of taking care of people, the more that you drive in traffic. You know, tightrope walkers, do you know how those people that got way up in the air and they're doing that stuff? You know how they start? They start with a rope down on the ground almost because you got to learn. And when it's low, you can fall off a dozen times and it won't hurt you. But they keep raising the thing because, and the higher it gets, the more you better pay attention because that fall won't just break your bones anymore. It'll kill you. And one of the things that happens is the more success you get in this life, the more you're going up in terms of that, the higher the tightrope is that you're walking on. And his business was a success at this point. And he's driving in traffic. Boy, he's really driving. But his family's going to be a mess. You know, his family is going to be a mess. He's doing a good job of running the kingdom, his business. And those two things you need to think about, job and family, your business and your family. And things don't go well for him in terms of family. Okay, verses 11 and 12, this is where the success shows. And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees, also carpenters and masons who built David a house. This is in Jerusalem now. And David perceived that the Lord had established him king over Israel and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. Now, you need to take note of that. And I'm going to stop with this stuff because these two things. You know, all this time David is going and he's been in relationship with God constantly. He's looking for God, and we've gone through this stuff, and he'd say, what do I do now, Lord? What do I do now? And then he would do whatever God told him to do, and that's basically like you or me. When we're in prayer, we say, well, I need to figure out where to go with my life in terms of this circumstance or this situation, and he's doing that, and he has been doing that for years. That's relationship. And he does what God wants him to do. He does that. In other words, he is faithful to God's leading and according to God's will for his life. And so he does that. And he's been doing it for years. Through all the bad times and now the good times. And here it comes. And it says in verse 12, and David perceived that the Lord has established him king over Israel. He came to the realization, God put me here. God made me king. God gave me all this. He perceived that God, that the Lord had established him as king. In other words, he came to the realization, all this success that I have, everything that God has given to me, he did it for the sake of the people that I'm over. And he takes care of that in terms of that. But at this point, I think that that verse is really important because he came to the realization, it's the great aha, you might say, says, my God, I have all this, and God gave it to me. Suddenly, I understand. And he gave it to me to make sure that my people are taken care of. I think there's a place in terms of our lives as well where we can come to that kind of perception. You know, God has been with me all my life. Sometimes I'm more aware of it than others, but I know this. He has given me everything that I have become king over. And when he came to that realization, he knew it. He was exalted for the sake of God's people. I'm going to leave you with that because, in a certain sense, we're all kings and queens. And where do you find yourself today? Let's pray. Lord, I ask that in the life of David, you would give us examples for us to learn from, that we can be aware of how you work in our lives and how you work in people's lives around us and how you want us to be in relationship with you, to be faithful as your people from our hearts and our minds. In Jesus' name, amen.